गुरवे गौर चंदाय राधिकाय तुताले कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। यम प्रव्रजन्तम अनुपेतम अपेत कृत्यम द्वैपायनो विरह कातर याजुहाव पूत्रैति तन्मयतयो तरवो विनेरुस तं सर्वभूत हृदय मुनि मानतोस्मि। श्याम सुंदर शिकंद शेखर स्मरहा सुमुरली मनोहरा राधिकर सिख मम कृप निधे सुप्रिय चाणकिं करिं कुरु। तवैव अस्मि ना जीवामि तया बिना इति विज्ञाय राधे तं नयमां चयनन्तिकम्। सो फर्स्ट ऑफ ऑल आई ऑफर माय प्रणाम टू माय होली मास्टर ओम विष्णुपाद श्रीमद् भक्तिवेदान्त नारायण गोस्वामी महाराज एंड टू my this succession Guru Parampara and to all the assembled devotees. So tonight we'll take this opportunity to discuss, because it's Gopastami, we'll tell some pastimes of Gopastami afterwards. First, some basic philosophical ideas of Krishna Bhakti. Now we can call this discussion the humble ego. Seems like what? Oxymoron. The humble ego? Seems like
oxymoron. Yeah, it seems like.
Do you
have the tape recorder?
This word, ego, began its life in the in Latin. It's simply the first person singular pronoun in the nominative case. Ego. Just means I. That's all. But throughout the centuries, gradually, this simple first person singular nominative pronoun collected so much semantic potential because it's been used in so many different ways. In popular usage, then the ego might mean anything from your innocuous self-esteem that everyone should have, up to pathological narcissism,
right?
The same word, it can apply to anything,
right,
on a sliding scale. And then, in the academic world, it has more specific applications, such as in metaphysics, it would refer to one's sense of identity. Or say, in psychoanalysis, then ego is the mediator between the id and the superego. The ego is that aspect of your personality that mediates between instinctual drives on the one hand and your social conscience on the other. So this ego, this word that was so simple ego in the beginning, just the word I, has just collected many, many layers and layers of meaning and interpretive possibilities. And we use it a lot, especially when it comes to spirituality. What happens? Gradually, after some time, there's a great interest here in the West in Eastern spirituality. Now, the word, what's the word for ego in Sanskrit? It may be in the writings of the Hindu writings, in Buddhist writings.
Ahankar.
Yeah. So generally, we find this word in Sanskrit, ahankar. And because the simple word ego was taken on so many meanings, it seemed that the word ego was a very likely candidate and suitable candidate to be a synonym for the Sanskrit word ahankar, which means ego. Now, what happens? One thing we can say is that here in the West, developmental psychologists have studied how people grow and how they perceive things. And the first thing that is found is that children are completely egocentric. Small children, babies, they're completely egocentric. That doesn't mean that they think that they are the center of everything, but they lack the capacity to be introspective and think about themselves at all. And they cannot identify with the feelings and experiences of others. Like a small child will mumble to you, blah, 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 and it feels as if that you, inevitably will understand its mumblings. It cannot imagine that you can't understand what it's mumbling, the meaning of it. And will begin to cry if you don't understand. And other experiments have done, for example, if you take a four-year-old child and you take a book, which is orange on one side and blue on the other, and you show the person, what color is this? This is orange. Yeah? And then you show the other side, what color is this? This is blue. Okay? So then you ask them, what are you seeing? They'll say, I'm seeing blue. And then you ask them, what am I seeing? They'll say, you're seeing blue. They know one side is orange and one side is blue. But they think that you're seeing what they're seeing. It's so simple like that, about the age 4 or 5. And then at 6, 7, then all of a sudden, the person develops a capacity to have empathy with someone else and look at something from another person's point of view. And therefore, Western developmental psychologists, they've postulated that the whole process of psychological development is the gradual decline of egocentricity. Now, as far as... It's clear? Now, as far as the Indian spiritual traditions and other Eastern spiritual traditions are concerned, what is their relationship or policy towards ahankar or ego? The policy is, has to go. It has to go. You've got to get rid of it. What's standing between you and enlightenment? Between ignorance and enlightenment? What?
The ego.
The ego, right? What's standing between me and the truth?
The ego.
Not me. The word me. Right? The ego. So, it's got to go. This is the way that it's been interpreted. So, on the one hand, in Western psychology, there's the gradual decline of the ego is being considered to be the development of knowledge, understanding, etc. And in Eastern culture as well, there's an idea that ahankar, which we call ego in English, it has to go. Now, how far does it have to go? Does it go down to... How far down does it go? It has to go down to zero, that it's gone completely? So if the ego will be gone completely, then along with the concept of the selfhood, all other concepts also will be just completely gone, nothing left. And that's what some persons might call the enlightenment, when the ego is completely out of the way, no ego. The Satori moment, moksha, mukti, nirvana, so many ideas related to that moment when there's no more conception of I, the ego, the self, no selfhood at all. That will be enlightenment. So, now let's come back to the word for ego in Sanskrit, because we have to examine it a little more closely. The word ahankar, which has been translated practically consistently throughout all academic texts and popular texts on Indian philosophy, the word ahankar is translated as ego. But actually, the word ahankar does not mean ego at all. Let's break it down. The first, it's made of two words, aham and kara. The word aham means I am. And the word, now this is where, if the word had only been aham, would have been ego, because ego in Latin means I am also. Ego sum, I am. But the word ahankara, aham means I am in Sanskrit, and kara comes from kridatu, the verb to do or to act. So ahankar doesn't mean ego. Ahankar actually means I am doing or I am acting. So what we have here is that consistently over the years, the Indian word ahankar has been translated everywhere, practically across the board, as ego. Now, the ahankar has to go. And then if you take ahankar to mean ego, that means that your very existence as an individual being has to go, and that's enlightenment. But that's not what the Puranas, the Veda, Vedanta, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, that's not what they're actually saying. Because they speak about something that has to go, that is called ahankar. I am acting. I am the doer. So, in Bhagavad Gita there's a famous verse, Prakrite kriyamanani gunaye karmani sarvashaha ahankaram vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. What does it mean? Prakrite kriyamanani. The self, which is not the physical body, bewildered by the influence of false ego, ahankar, bewildered by the influence of ahankar, ego, thinks that I am doing the activities which are actually carried out by nature. Now this is an amazing thing. When we think of nature, what do we think of? We think of the natural world around us. So now the summer is over and the autumn is coming, then the winter will come, then the spring will come. Did you do that? Did you make the summer go?
No.
Did you?
No.
But who's responsible? Who made the summer go?
I did.
It was you. Okay. Arrest that man. Bring it back at once. Now, obviously, we would never consider ourselves to be the doers of the activities of nature, right? We don't think that we make the sunshine, or rise or set, or the seasons turn around. That was happening before we were here. It's happening now. It will be happening when we're gone. So we're not responsible for that. But here Gita is explaining that the activities of this body are the activities of nature. They're like the activities of nature in the sense that we're not doing them. We're not doing them. This body is breathing, it goes to sleep, it wakes up. We feel as if we are in control of the body and in control of the mind. But here the Gita is saying, no, the activities of the body and the mind are controlled by nature. Here it's called prakriti. The whole material energy is vibrating in three stages: sattva, raja and tama. Sattva means the energy of stability that maintains something's existence for a time. Inevitably, things degrade and destruct and they disintegrate. This is called tama or destruction. And again, new things come out from the total energy. So just as one might make a pot from some clay and then smash the pot and mixes back into the earth again. And then again one can take the clay and make something else. So the total material energy remains constant. But from it, a rajas, the mode of passion, makes creation. Sattva maintains things for some time. And then tamas destroys them again. So the energies of creation, maintenance and destruction bring about all the activities of the physical body and the mind. But the soul, the self, the conscious self within, is thinking, I am doing all of these things. I am waking up, going to sleep, going here and there, building a skyscraper, demolishing the skyscraper, whatever we're doing. But the self, because of identifying with the body, thinks that I'm doing all of these things. So this is what meditation is about. Meditation is how to make the mind steady. In Gita, Krishna said, Samatvam yoga uchate. Yoga means equilibrium of mind. To be in a state of equilibrium all the time. To not become greedy, angry, irritable, lusty, thirsty, hungry. What? Mind is always fluctuating and then sending out waves of feelings of insufficiency towards the physical body. And then the body needs. We need this. We need so many things. So when the mind is in equilibrium, the demands of the mind and the projected demands of the mind onto the body, they gradually diminish. And one comes to a state of equilibrium that's called, in Gita, yoga. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the same thing is stated there. Yogas citta vritti nirodaha. That yoga is the complete restraint of the modifications within one's field of consciousness. So just as if you see your reflection in water, but the water's moving, the reflection appears to be moving. So in the same way, when the mind is not in equilibrium, then the self feels himself to be moving and going here and there and doing so many things. But when the mind is in equilibrium, then one can see, I am the witness of the activities of the body and the mind. So, here in Gita, Krishna puts forward in this verse the idea that actually the self is not doing, but he thinks that he's doing. And because the mind is disturbed, he generates in his life many needs and requirements for things that he doesn't really need, and also greed. And for this, he will have to compete and fight with his fellow man and nature and animals and everything. And thus the chaos that we call everyday life ensues. Now, other philosophers throughout history have put forward a similar idea. Perhaps you know that Socrates, it was announced by the oracle at Delphi that Socrates was the wisest man in the world. But Socrates was thinking, well, I don't know anything. And he went here and there, interviewing various people, military people, artistic people, writers, government officials, politicians, and to ask them about their views. And what did he find? He found that everyone thought that they knew something, but when they were examined very closely, their ideas were riddled with contradictions. He said, I went to see a poet, a famous poet, and he'd written beautiful poetry, and many people would comment on his poetry. And I went to ask him, what's the meaning? What's the meaning of your poetry? And he explained it. And Socrates said, well, I can tell you that any one of you here could have explained his poetry better than he could, being the author of the poetry. He said, at that time...
Did he say, I know what I know nothing? That's Socrates.
It will come.
Good.
He didn't say it at this point yet.
Okay.
So then he said that, I think that this poet, anyone could have explained his poetry better than he could explain it. So the conclusion is that when we do something, when we compose something or write something or create some art, that there's some genius that is beyond us, that uses us as a medium to manifest in this plane, and that we're not really responsible for those creations that we might take credit for. So here's an example. In the end, Socrates said, actually, the oracle was just using me as an example. What the message was really meant to say is that if any man or woman, like Socrates, understands that he doesn't or she doesn't know anything, then that person is the wisest person, because they're free from pretension, from pretending to know something, or being bewildered into thinking that they've understood something. Now, this will tie in with today's festival also of Gopastami.
Yes.
You could remind me, we'll speak about Gopastami afterwards. There was another literary critic here in the West, in France actually, his name was Roland Barthes, and he caused a big revolution in the literary world by writing an article called The Death of the Author. He said that when we read books and we try to understand them, what do? We read the text and we try to find out what was the original intention of the author of this book. And the closer we can get to the original intention of the author, then that is the best or better literary understanding. So I said, no, wait a minute. When we speak or when we write something, then what is coming from our mouths or from our pens? It's not our own voice, but rather it's a mixture. It's a braid of voices. Whose voices? The voice of your mother, the voice of your father, the voice of your brothers and sisters, the voice of your teacher at school, the voice of someone you heard on the radio or on TV. And all of these influences in your life have mixed together and they now are producing an echo in the form of the words coming from your mouth or written on the page. So when we're reading something and thinking, oh, so this person is the author of this book, they're not the author of this book, but rather there's a detective, one like a detective, can search out what other, you can try, but it's impossible, to discover all the thousands of voices that have braided together to become the voice which is on this page. So this was called the death of the author, and he postulated that the death of the author created what? The birth of the reader. Because now literary criticism is not reduced to reading a book to find out what the author wanted to say. Forget about what the author wanted to say. Let's see what the reader thinks that it might mean. So now you get something like, you can take a play of Shakespeare and then analyze this from the point of view of feminist politics, from the point of view of psychology, psychoanalysis, from the point of view of modernism, postmodernism, or any point of view. It doesn't matter whether or not Shakespeare, when he wrote it, he was thinking of any of these things. But now the reader has been born. Now the author has died, and let's interpret in thousands of different ways. So here we see that the concept that I am not the doer of activities opens great realms in thinking, seeing life in another way. And philosophers like Socrates and literati like Roland Barthes have also put forward similar ideas. Now I'd just like to say that everything I've said so far in this lecture this evening is wrong. Completely wrong. So let's go to the next stage.
Hold on, I have one question.
Can you say it to the end? Because you're on a roll. Now, if we go a little bit further into the Gita, and we come to the last chapter, actually, what do we find there? There Krishna tells Arjuna, there are five factors of action. Five factors in every action. They are what? The body, the physical body. If I say to you, come here, you can come because you have two legs. You know, if someone removed those legs, it would be very difficult for you to come here. So that's one of the ingredients in any activity. The abilities, the capabilities, etc. of the physical structure that is inhabited by our soul, the body. Now, in addition to that, there are also the senses. The second factor of action, or another factor of action, are the senses. Now, we all have five senses, and for us here, we're lucky, all five senses are in working order. But if the senses are not working, that will also limit the capacity to act. And sometimes the senses are not working, not because they're impaired, but because of lack of concentration. For example, I might be talking, but if someone is sitting here and their mind is thinking, did I lock my front door before I came here? And you're thinking, did I lock the door? Do I have my key? Like this. Now, you have two ears. You have the power to hear too. But then all of a sudden, you think, yeah, I do remember. I did lock the door. And then, but you didn't hear anything I said. Right? So the senses might be there. But unless it's connected to the mind, unless there's some concentration, they don't function. So, you know, and that's how accidents happen. Someone is thinking about something and they step off the curb and the bus goes splat. Right? Because they can see the bus, they can hear the bus, but they didn't see it, they didn't hear it. Because the mind was somewhere else. So, here's an activity, stepping off the curb. Did I do it or did I not do it? Yes, you did it. But, what was the result? Very painful. And so, now the thing is here, so we're looking at factors of action. Now, another factor of action is endeavor. Now, a lot of people say that according to the law of karma, that you get what's coming to you if it's coming to you. So you don't have to do anything. But in the Gita, Krishna says, Nahi kaschit chanamapi jatu tischatya karma krit. One cannot even stay alive without doing something. So everyone has to act in this world. And so endeavor is also part of becoming successful or achieving one's aims. Srila Prabhupada used to say, man proposes and God disposes. You try and the result may or may not come, that's in the hands of God. You can try, but whether you get the result or not. But if you don't try, then you definitely won't get the result. So you must endeavor. So we're going through the factors of action. The body, the senses, the endeavor. Now the next factor of action is the self. Now this is astonishing. In Vedanta Sutra, there, this concept is raised. That the self is actually, is an actor, is a doer. But wait a minute, I thought we were supposed to become free from ahankar, the idea that I am acting. So now it starts, the Bhagavad Gita moves into the realm of complex literature, because it's not so black and white. It's not, we like to think in, you know, binary terms, one or zero, on or off. Those brain synapses are either firing or they're not firing. It's either the Republicans or the Democrats. Right? The brain likes to make things black and white. But actually, reality is complex. So here, Krishna brings up the concept that actually the self is one of the factors of action. So the self actually is the doer. Even though in an earlier verse in Gita, Krishna said, you're someone who thinks I am the doer is bewildered by his ahankar, ego, whatever. So, how can we reconcile this? Let's look at the fifth factor of action. The fifth factor is Paramatma, God, in the heart of everyone, in every atom, controlling everything. So your body may be in order, your senses may be in order, you may do the endeavor, and you are, as the self, also acting in some capacity. Come to that afterwards. But if God does not permit, then it's not going to happen. Simply not going to happen. Now, modern people in the modern age generally think in a mechanistic way, that the world, the universe, is ruled by laws of physics. So there's no room for God to play a role in what's going on in the world, because it would violate the laws of physics, right? Yeah? Right or not right?
Not right.
Well, yeah, but it seems there's been a concept since the you know, the Lisbon earthquake took place, and after that there was a great faithlessness that took over Europe, and from that came the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment thinkers such as John Locke, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, and they revolutionized the way that we looked at the world. The world was no longer in the hands of God, but the world was a machine that works according to particular fixed laws. So now everything is fixed and deterministic. There's no room, there's no space for God to interfere or play a role in anyone's life. Not so simple. Probably most people are aware that in recent times there was the development of chaos theory, which means that big events are very much dependent on the initial conditions. And if the initial conditions of any event are adjusted slightly, everything will come out differently. I can give a simple example. Let's just say that we have a box in front of us, and there are some billiard balls there. So if you take one ball and you shoot it at those billiard balls, they're going to go in a particular direction according to the laws of physics, right? We all know, you can calculate that. But if you adjust the angle of your first shot by a tiny degree, everything will move in a completely different way, also according with the laws of physics. If you adjust it a little bit more, everything will be different again. So that's just the shot of one ball against a few. But actually, the entire universe is made of millions and millions of incalculable reactions going on at all the time. Now for, say, Newtonian physics or the modern laws of science to give accurate results on predictions, they only have to be accurate to within 10 to the minus 21 of a meter. And if there are any adjustments less than that, they cannot be accounted for within the laws of physics. But because a tiny adjustment in a very small event is there, it will still bring out a different result. So the conclusion is that if there's any adjustment in anything on a level that we cannot measure, it will still produce measurable results on the macro scale. In other words, even though we experience day to day on the gross world some laws which seem to be pretty deterministic, there's still within that the room for some conscious living entity to be controlling the world at every moment and do whatever he likes without any breach of the laws of physics, even. Though, I mean, obviously God is independent, he can do what he likes. Yet still, there's scientifically a level at which everything can be controlled that is experienced. Controlled on a micro level, and that will be experienced on the macro level. And that's also written in the Brahma Samhita, that God is present within every single atom of the universe, and he controls from there, from the atomic level. So, we've been discussing five factors of action. In every activity, five things come together to make something happen. The body, the senses, the endeavor, the type of endeavor, the self, and the super soul, Paramatma, the supreme soul, God, who is present everywhere. These are, according to Gita, the five factors of action. So now we have some loose ends to reconcile. What are those loose ends? Well, we've already heard that the living entity who thinks he's the doer is bewildered. But now we hear in chapter 18 of Gita that actually the self is doing something. So the question comes, what is the self doing? What does the Atma do? So in Vedanta Sutra, there it's stated that the self is acting like a carpenter, in two ways like a carpenter. Now, a carpenter acts in two ways. One way is, he holds the chisel. That's one way that the carpenter acts. And the other way is, he beats it and then the chisel cuts the wood. So he's acting directly by holding the chisel and indirectly through the instrument. Okay? These are the two ways. So in the same way, the soul, the self, within this complex unit called the body and mind is also acting in two ways. And that's been described in the Gita at 2. Where? Mamaivangso. Jivaloke. Yes? Does anyone know this verse of Gita? Yeah? Oh, might have another group. He's very learned in this. Mamaivangso jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. First of all, here in this verse, Krishna says, Mamaivangsa. Every soul is one of my expanded subjective conscious portions. Angsa means a part, but not a part like a piece of paper. If you tear a piece of paper into small parts, then the paper's gone. God's not like that. God expands in parts without any diminution on his own part. So every soul is like a tiny atomic part of God, Gita said. And that part is sanatan. That means eternal. So the idea that the ego will go away and then the self will no longer exist, this is not supported by Gita. Because the individual self remains an individual forever. Now what is he doing? Manashastanindriyani prakritistani karshati. Here the word karshati means he is, karshati means to draw towards himself or attract. Actually like the word Krishna.
Krishna.
The word Krishna comes from the Sanskrit kridatu, karshati, he attracts. So Krishna is called Krishna because he attracts. So the living entity here, karshati, he's attracting the mind and the senses. So here it's described that the soul does something. He attracts towards himself the mind and senses, and then he acts through them in the world. You understand? So that's why it said the soul is like a carpenter. Because the carpenter doesn't cut the wood with his own hands, he cuts the wood with a chisel, but he holds the chisel in his hand. So in the same way, the soul does not act in the world, but the soul draws the senses and the mind towards itself, then acts in the world through the instruments of the senses. So karshati in Sanskrit, this is an active verb. The soul is acting. Now, Baldev Vidyabhushan in his commentary on Vedanta Sutra says some important things. If we say that the self is really a no-self and that the self is not acting, then there would be no reason in the Vedas to give people instruction like practice yoga, do karma yoga, do jnana yoga, control your mind, control your senses, don't become intoxicated, don't kill animals. If the self was a no-self, he didn't exist as an individual who could act, then there would be no necessity to tell him to do anything because he couldn't respond. And therefore, it is established, because the Vedas, Upanishads, the Puranas, are full of imperative sentences. Yeah? There are orders, there are imperative sentences there, that the self is an individual that acts, because if he wasn't, then the imperative sentences would be complete nonsense. Okay? Now, it's established that the individual is acting, but he's not acting completely independently, but rather his ability to act is contingent upon the other four factors of action. And so the enlightened soul, the enlightened ego, is what? Is the humble ego. Ego meaning here the sense of I. And the enlightened ego is not a person. If you go through the stages, in the first stage, ego is I am great. Ego means staring at oneself in the mirror and trying to be more attractive than others, to push others down and to lift oneself. And so the first idea was this has to go because it's a block to spirituality. So you get rid of the ego, then what are you left with? You'll be nothing. But Gita said no. The ego is not the sense of I, but it's the sense of ahankara. I am acting. So the soul is not directly acting in this world. So I'm doing nothing. If you crash the car and say, hey, you crashed my car. Say, it's okay. Ahankara vimudatma akarta amiti manyate. According to the Gita, I didn't crash your car. Because I am not the doer. Hey, you stole my wallet. I didn't do it. Because ahankara vimudatma akarta I'm not the doer. I didn't crash your car. I didn't steal your wallet. I didn't break any of the principles. I didn't take any drugs or do anything, because I'm not the doer, right? Wrong. So these are the stages. The real conception is not that we're not the doer, but the conception is that the self is the contingent doer. That the self is not the whole story, and he's not the story, but he's a small part of the story. The body, the senses, the endeavor, God, and the self. All five together are the contribute to the activity and the result of any activity. So the real solution to the ego is not to get rid of the I, and not even to get rid of the I am the doer, but to be very humble and realize that I am the contingent doer. This is the complex philosophy or conception which is actually given by the Vedas, Vedanta, Upanishad, the Puranas, and the Bhagavad Gita. It's not as easy as black and white to be the doer or not the doer, but to have a humble ego and be the contingent doer. Is that clear?
What about the witness?
One of the five factors.
That's Paramatma. That's God, the Paramatma.
It's not us witnessing?
We're also witnessing. We're also experiencing and through our senses. But we're also acting.
We're contingent
actors.
You said earlier, I am a witness instead of I am the doer.
Yes, because at that point I was dealing with the...
No.
At that point I was dealing with the conception that the self is not doing anything. If we think I am only the witness, then we're not doing anything, but it's not true.
Right.
Okay, so today, I want to conclude the philosophical discussion here, because it's taxing to the brain. And so, let's just conclude our lecture or discussion this evening, because we can continue to discuss things after the prasadam. But today, in India, is a very special day. So we're moving to the realm of culture now. Today is a very special day. It's called Gopashtami. So the word Gop means, well, let's come to the word Go. The word Go means cow, and the syllable Pa means palan, to protect. So Gopa means a person who protects cows, grazes cows. So According to the Puranas, Gita, and other texts of India, the Supreme Personality of Godhead would rather not be God. You know, I think people in this world, they can be ambitious and they try to work their way to the top. But when they get to the top of their field, then sometimes it's lonely at the top. And they become suicidal even. And so, if we would put ourselves in God's position for a moment and think, well, what would it like to be God? To control everything and everyone. I mean, if someone organized a surprise party for you, you know, they open the door and say, surprise, then you say, well, I knew you were going to do that because I know everything. So immediately, being God would be boring, right? Because you already know everything before it happens. Hey, this new movie came out. I've seen it. It doesn't come out until next week. I know everything. Past, present, and future. So it would be a little bit boring. And another thing is, I mean, if you want to play, do anything with anyone, you play any game, well, who's going to be the winner? I mean, sport is all about not knowing who's the winner, who's going to be the winner and the loser. So if you know everything, and also you're the best at everything, then being God would probably drive one to suicide. Okay, so the Vedas give a conception that the Supreme Consciousness that pervades everything likes to play. And therefore, in order to facilitate play and intimacy and excitement, that is called in Sanskrit Leela, play is called Leela in Sanskrit, God has an energy called Yoga Maya. And just as illusion covers us in this world and makes us think that we are black or white or young or old or male or female or American or English or Russian, exclusive doer, or not the doer of anything. So Maya, illusion, works in this way in the material world to make us forget who the soul is. Yoga Maya is God's energy that makes God forget that He's God, so that He can play. And what does He play? He plays
Gopa.
As a Gopa. We're coming now to Gopa. He plays in a very beautiful rural village. God likes to be close to nature. He doesn't like to be close to a power station or anything. Yeah? So God plays like a simple boy, ordinary boy, and also a girl. And so the two aspects of the Godhead playing are called Radha and Krishna. The Radha aspect, the female aspect of the Godhead, is also called Hara, which in the vocative case becomes Hare. So the mantra, Hare Krishna, is a meditation on the play of the male and female aspects of the Godhead. Mm-hmm. So today in India is a day called Gopastami. Astami means the eighth day of the moon. You'll notice that 8 days ago was the new moon. And today is the eighth day after the new moon. That's called in Sanskrit Ashtami. And this is the day when Krishna, playing as a cowherd boy, he played as a one-year-old boy, a two-year-old boy, a three-year-old boy. When he got to the age of five, he began to feel very great attraction and interest in the girls in his village. But being a five-year-old boy, he stayed at home, always in his mother's lap, always in the house. He could never go out and get away from his mum and be with the gopis. Gopa means male and gopi is the female. He wanted to be with the gopis. So he thought, well, you know, in our community, we're supposed to take the cows out into the forest to graze. So now I'm 5 years old, maybe I could take the cows out into the forest to graze, and that would be my ticket to go and meet with the gopis and play with the girls without my mother being around. So that, in other words, that Hara could meet with Krishna, Hare Krishna. So we know that Krishna worships cows. And why? Because cows are considered to be the embodiment of all the various gods are present in the body of a cow. But the main reason why Krishna bows down to the cows, why he even washes the feet of the cows, is because the cows are Krishna's ticket to go and meet with Radha. So, now as parents are, you know, parents are very protective over their children. So when Krishna, being 5 year old, said, "Mom, I want to go out into the forest and graze the cows," it's a good alibi. When he came up with this idea, his mother wasn't into it. She really was into it, because mothers are very protective over their children. So, Purnamasi Devi, Yogamaya personified in Vrindavan, suggested to her that no, he should go and play. Now he's growing up, he'll have to learn to take care of the cows. But he's a small boy, so he shouldn't take out the cows, because they're too big and boisterous and rough. He should just take out the calves. The small, just born calves. And not the male ones, because they're too frisky. Just the tame, quieter female calves. He can take those out and not go very far, just outside the village somewhere. So this was the day, the very first day, that Krishna, playing as a 5-year-old boy, ventured out with the calves. But it was very difficult to get out, because he was about to go and all of his little friends came to meet with him. And he was about to go and Mother Yashoda said, "Oh, Kanai, come on, come here, come back. I forgot something." And she took a talisman. You know, they're called kavacha in India. And she took a kavacha and she tied it onto his arm. "So I want to put this kavacha on you to protect you, that you don't get into any problems, because so many demons and dangerous people come to the forest of Vrindavan. Agasura, Trinavarta, Putana, and so many others." So she put a kavacha on him. Then he went to go, and he was about to go with his friends. "Say, hey, come back." And she called him back again and began to put rings on his fingers. Why? Because you can have moonstones and different planetary gems that influence this, they affect the astrological influences. And she began to decorate him with different gems so that there wouldn't be any inauspicious astrological influences on him. And then he was going, "Hey, come back." And by now Krishna was getting embarrassed in front of it. "Oh, mom, he was embarrassed in front of his friends. So then Madhya Shoda was telling his friends, "You, Stoka Krishna, you go in front of him. Hey, Balabhadra, you go this side. Mandalibhadra, you go this side." And Madhya Shoda was saying, "His friends, you have to all stand around him at all times and make sure he doesn't get into any trouble or any problems." And then he was on his way. "Hey, come back, come back, come back. What if you get hungry?" So then she prepared something and made a lunch pack, and in this way again and again. And finally, Krishna went to the forest and his mother was crying. "Oh, my boy is finally flying the nest." But he was only going very close by. So this year he was 5. And one day, at the eight, when he was 5 years old, he went into the forest to a forest called Vatsavan. And at that time, one great demigod called Lord Brahma, he came. And he thought, "What will happen if I steal all of Krishna's friends and their calves?" So Lord Brahma, when Krishna wasn't looking, took all the friends and calves and hid them in a cave. So when Krishna turned around and came back to the bank of the Jamuna where he thought his friends were, they were all gone. And Krishna thought, "Oh no, disaster. I went out into the forest with all my friends and the calves, and now I've lost them all. If I go back by myself, my mother will be angry." So, because this 5-year-old boy was worried about what his mother might say, there was only one thing for it. There's only one way to get out of trouble. And that is to expand himself and become all the boys and all the calves. And then he went back into the village, expanded as all, you know, has anyone seen The Matrix?
Yes.
You know, like Agent Smith? Right? And he expands himself into thousands of forms. Well, God can do that in his sleep. That's easy for him. So, Krishna, he expanded himself into thousands of forms, but they weren't all the same. He became all of his different friends, every single one and every calf also. And they came back to the village, and each friend went home. "Hi, mom." And they went to their houses and they went to sleep. Next morning, Krishna wakes up in the morning. All of his friends come knocking on his door to call for him. But who are they? They're all Krishna himself, coming out from the homes, pretending to be all the friends, coming to his door, knocking and calling on him to say, "Come on, let's go out for grazing the calves." All the calves are him too. So this pastime, this leela, this is play. It's called the play of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it's very elaborate, and it will take at least 3 hours to explain it. So I'm not going to go into the details today. But we can say that Lord Brahma, the demigod who had stolen all of the boys, he thought, "Let me steal them and then see what happens." So Lord Brahma, he returned to his planet, Brahmalok. And he went to his planet there, and he was returning to his palace. But when he came to the palace, the door was closed. He couldn't get in. So he knocked on the door, and the doorman opened the door and said, "Get out of here," and shut the door in his face. Now, he's the king. Brahmaji, this demigod, is the king of this planet. And now his little doorman won't let him in. He's slamming the door in his face. Again, he was knocking. Mm-hmm. And then the doorman said, "Hey, you're an imposter. Get out of here. You're not Brahma. Brahma's sitting on the throne right now." So then Brahma realized, "Oh my, I've done the wrong thing here. I'm messing around. This little boy, he's playing like a little boy, but he's not. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he knows everything. I left him on the bank of the Yamuna, crying, looking for his friends. Hey, Subal, Sridham, where are you?" And tears were coming in his eyes, looking for his friends. But he's tricking me. And Krishna himself had manifested a form, not only of the boys and the calves, but also of Brahma, and was sitting on Brahma's throne, and he told the doorman, "Someone's going to come here and try to impersonate me and get into the palace. So when he comes, you just abuse him and shut the door in his face." So then Brahma thought, "Okay, I've made a big mistake. It's time to go back to Earth." So when he came back to Earth, it wasn't a few minutes later. It was a whole year later because of time dilation. Now, you might say that Albert Einstein discovered time dilation in, you know, the early 20th century, in the early 1900s. But actually, you can read in the Vedas, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the description of time dilation between various planets is written down there 5,000 years ago. So here in this pastime of Krishna, written 5,000 years ago, there's an example of time dilation, that he went to another planet with a higher gravity and then came back, and it was 1 year, even though it was only a few minutes in his dimension. So he came back to Earth, and he looked and saw that Krishna was playing with his friends. So, "Wait a minute, I stole all the friends and put them in the cave." So then Brahma, he went to the cave and saw all the friends were there. So then he came back and saw all the friends with Krishna, and he thought, "What's going on? Does Krishna, when I'm looking, I see the friends, and then when I go to the cave, does he get them all and put them in the cave? And I see them again? And then when I come back, then he gets them all and puts them back? Is that what he does?" So then, luckily Brahma, he's got four heads. So two heads look towards the Yamuna and two heads look towards the cave. And he saw that there were boys on the bank of the Yamuna and in the cave. The same. And then he thought, "What's going on?" So then he looked at the boys, and as he was staring at them, they began to change complexion. Every one of them began to turn kind of a blue complexion, like that statue there. Everyone became bluish and manifested four arms, four-handed forms. And not only that, but around them, all living entities, from demigods, he saw thousands of Brahmas like himself, thousands of Shivas, thousands of Ganeshis. He saw all living entities from the top to the bottom of the universe, even down to small blades of grass. And they were all singing and dancing. And what were they singing? "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." Every living entity in the universe, from the great gods down to tiny blades of grass, there were millions of them around each boy who had assumed a bluish form with four hands, and they were all doing kirtan. And the light emanating from them was so vast that Brahma could hardly see. And it was blinding him. And he said, "Kim idam." Actually, he didn't say "Kim idam," because his eyes became stunned, his ears were stunned, he couldn't even speak. Only he could think. And his mind said, in his mind he said, "Kim idam," which is Sanskrit for, "What is that?" "What is that?" And then he was so overpowered by the power and the opulence and the greatness, the majesty of his vision, that he fainted and became unconscious. He didn't know how long he was unconscious, but the next moment when he came back into sense, he looked and saw there was a little five-year-old boy wandering on the bank of the river with tears in his eyes, looking for his friends. "Subal, Sridham, Madhumangal, where are you?" This is why Vedanta Sutra says, "Om Atato Brahma Jigyasa." Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Generally people think it means, "Atato, now therefore, Brahma Jigyasa." one should jigyas, inquire into Brahma, the absolute truth. Hmm? But the confidential meaning is, now therefore, now because God likes to play like an ordinary boy, Brahma jigyasa, Brahma, the absolute truth, is inquiring. Sridham, where are you? Madhumangal, where are you? This is Atato Brahma Jigyasa. So he's looking for his friends. And then Lord Brahma, he realized that actually I put my nose, in fact my four noses, where they don't belong. And he got down from his swan carrier and he fell at the feet of this boy. And he bowed down again and again and offered many prayers. And one of the prayers goes like this. He said, "Oh my Lord."
Hmm? Exactly. Oh my God.
He said, "Confirm. Hey, listen. Who said that there's no God? I mean, that's the evidence."
He said it just now.
Yeah, exactly. And he prayed, and he said that there are many people who think that they know you. There are many people who think that they know you, God, and they speak so many things, but I don't have so much to say because, as far as I am concerned, everything about you is beyond the reach of my body, my mind, and my words. So I simply bow down to you. And I say that those people who try to know the truth by their intellect, they will all fail. Because you cannot be understood by the intellect. But those who will simply listen to your beautiful play, your pastimes, they will not know you, but they will learn to love you. They will get love, and that is the highest goal of life. So Brahmaji prayed like this: Gane prayasamuda pasyana manta eva jivanti sanmukaritam bhavadiya vartam. Don't try to know reality. Try to love reality, and then it will be revealed by service, by loving service. That is called Bhakti Yoga. In Sanskrit, Bhakti Yoga. The yoga of devotion. By the yoga of knowledge, you cannot know, because so vast. There are many philosophies, but as Shakespeare said in Hamlet, "Oh my dear friend, there are many things on heaven and in earth which are not even dreamt of in your philosophy." So, the moral of the story is, we end where we began. The humble ego. Don't try to get rid of the ego and become God, but rather be very, very humble and serve and love God. This is the path of progress and enlightenment. So we'll conclude our discussion this evening with the kirtan to chant the names of Krishna, and afterwards there'll be a wonderful vegetarian feast that has been prepared and offered to Krishna by Gaur Premanandi.
Actually, Krishna Gauranga from New Dwarka Community prepared the feast.
Oh, yeah. And Krishna Gauranga? Kija. So let's have a kirtan and remember that beautiful cowherd boy and girl, Radha and Krishna, and then honor Prasadam.